Welcome to the Jewellers Podcast, the podcast that talks to jewellers, retailers and industry supporters about their experiences and insights into the jewellery industry. The Jewellers Podcast is brought to you by the Jewellery Industry Summit, preparing you for growth. In today's podcast, we chat to Simon Lane, who is the global CEO of Leading Edge Group. But before we jump into that interview, we have to talk a bit about our super exciting event coming up next week, the Jewellery Industry Virtual Fair. The virtual fair will be online on the 20th and 21st of October and will give you the ability to chat face-to-face with suppliers so that you can prepare for Christmas. Not only will you be able to meet with suppliers online, but you'll also be able to hear from some amazing industry leaders from all over Australia. If that's not reason enough to grab your ticket, the fair also has some really cool networking events. You can meet with your mates from all over the country or connect with new people and grow your network. Tickets are free, so make sure you don't miss this awesome event that you can attend from the comfort of your own home with your tracky dacks on. Tickets available at www.jewelleryindustryfair.com. Brett and I will be there to meet you face to face, and we can't wait. Now for today's podcast.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Jewellers Podcast. We're joined today by Simon from Leading Edge Jewellers. Hi, Simon.
Hi, Laura. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Welcome to the podcast today, Simon. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks, Brett. I'm happy to be here. Yeah.
Now, Simon Lane, you are the new global CEO of Leading Edge Group, which has multiple different categories in it. What's your background with the company?
Okay, well, firstly, thanks for having me on. The background I have with the company is quite an interesting one. I was in my previous life, an HR professional, and I chose that out of high school and worked in corporate all my life up till the late 90s, where I was chief manager of HR for the Commonwealth Bank, and moved out of that and set up an outsourced HR business, the first of its kind in Australia, and built that business over the next 20 years. As it happened, I ended up consulting to Leading Edge back around 2010, 2011, and maintained that for several years. And towards 2016, I was invited by the board to join the board as a director because of my knowledge of the company. So I started as a director in 2016. And in February this year, I was asked to take on the role of global CEO.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's an interesting role coming from HR. You must have a great understanding of obviously the culture that's required from all the different categories within the company.
Indeed, the people management is the key to everything. At the end of the day, every company is a group of people under a banner, and it's how the leadership of that business can galvanise those people around a cause and be effective in delivering on what the core purposes of that business was or is. And I think that I learned from my previous consulting role, which was with a company called Employers Mutual, who happened to be a large owner of or shareholder in Leading Edge. I learned there that that cause is very important to the success of the business. So EML, who are a major shareholder, they help injured workers. So their whole philosophy is about helping people get their lives back. And the advantage that they have in doing that is that it's a very easy message to get through to your employees and galvanize them around that mission. So when I arrived at Leading Edge, my first thought was, well, what is our mission? Why do we want to come to work? Why do the employees want to work here? And it took a little bit of thinking because we are in so many different categories of merchandise and the like. But what became quite apparent to me is that what we are about is helping small family businesses survive and thrive. And so by getting that message clear in the minds of everyone who works here, it has become very easy to get on with making sure that we can deliver on that. And so that was my first goal as the global CEO, was to get the messaging right and make sure that we understood why it's important to be part of this business. And when you look at Australian retail, 95% of businesses actually fall into the category that I've just described.
I think it's really good for our listeners too to understand that Leading Edge is, jewellery is only one arm of Leading Edge, and it's not just Australia, New Zealand, you're in the UK as well. So what other industries is Leading Edge working in?
So, yeah, it's a good question, Brett. Leading Edge in Australia is predominantly a retailer, and we provide support to businesses that are in quite an array of technology-based products and services, computers, hardware, software, appliances, electrical, but also books, entertainment, video, and, of course, jewellery. In New Zealand, we are an outsourced sales business predominantly, but also provide sales support to Spark, who are a leading telecoms business over there. And in the United Kingdom, we provide telecom support to British Telecom itself. That gives us a very unique position as a buying group, and I don't even like to think of us as a buying group. We provide more retail support. But the advantage we've got is because we are operating in different markets and different categories of merchandise, we can absorb the hits that come with being in an area that becomes vulnerable due to economic and social impacts such as COVID. And so our ability to float through that has been well supported by the fact that we are a diverse business and we've got money coming in from different angles.
Yeah, absolutely. You probably would see quite a few of your arms doing relatively well in these times and some that are definitely struggling. So the ability to dovetail off of each other is probably quite an important strategy for the company.
Well, absolutely, Laura. And I think that it's fair to say that if you are a jewellery business at the moment that is thriving, you're doing something very unique because the industry is under enormous pressure. When you look at all the categories of merchandise that we're in, and we carry 12 million SKUs. So we are obviously looking at a wide range of services that we provide through our to our members and the end consumer. But if you look at all of those, the thing that obviously hits me is that jewellery is a very discernible purchase. And it's one that is mired by all of the impacts of society as it currently stands. So firstly, it could be considered a luxury as opposed to a definite need that you must have. Mm-hmm. Secondly, unless you're being shown on a podcast, you don't get the opportunity to wear those earrings that you've got on. So people aren't buying as much jewellery because they haven't got a place to wear it. Of course, wearable wealth is the new flavour of jewellery. I suppose it's not that new, but in truth, people like to show that they've been successful and wear their jewellery and wear it out. But if you've got nowhere to go out to, you've got another problem. And then you've got the more severe elements, like in Victoria at the moment, where you get locked down altogether. And I think that that's had obviously a significant impact. We've had stores through our members closed down for significant periods of time because they are simply not allowed to trade. As you also appreciate, jewelers do their best advertising in their front window, and when they're closed, those windows are empty and there's no passing trade. So you've got to think completely differently about the industry itself. And I think that the advantage I've got is that I've got other categories that aren't facing any of those issues whatsoever, and that they've moved into the online world. And I know that we'll be talking a lot more about that as this conversation progresses. But the truth is that if you want to stay in bricks and mortar retail, you have to have a blended approach now, or you're just not going to survive.
100%. Yeah, it's a really good point. And I think from Leading Edge's point of view, you've got so many categories that support that online platform that, you know, jewellery and even your book sort of category, because they're not, you know, naturally in an online space, they can be supported by your other categories that are online.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's the biggest advantage that we have over some of our competition, is that if we were just in the jewellery business, I think that we'd be really struggling. And I know that talking to some of our members and some of our suppliers, they just simply haven't escaped the reality that COVID has brought with it. But for us being in a diversified environment, we have not missed budget since I got here. We have exceeded our trade from last year. We have had the best trading year in 4 years. We have turned in a seven-figure profit. And obviously our shareholders are more than delighted with us. But that's given us an opportunity to reinvest a lot of that capital back into our business and to shore up our online presence and to rethink our brand and create better benefits for our members going forward. So that's the luxury that we've got. We aren't cash poor. We're exactly the opposite. We've got multiple millions in the bank, which is lovely. We've also, as I said earlier, with large investors like EML, we have companies that are prepared to put money into us to continue our growth. We are offshore and growing offshore. So we're covered by a whole range of contingencies, if you like, that give us the flexibility and allows us to pivot in a way that our competition just can't. And so we're using this opportunity to reinvent ourselves quite significantly. And our members have been brilliant in trying to stay the course and support us as we try and support them. The difficulty is that I just can't get out there and visit them. I'm not allowed in many times to do that. And I find that is pretty painful because, as I said at the outset, I'm a people person. My whole career has been built around people management. To be able to get out there and talk to retailers and understand their situation is really important to me. What I didn't mention is in my history, I spent 8 years with Coles Myer. I was trained by them as a general manager. So my retail skills are very sharp. I learned so much from them and I applied that in my own business. But also for my luck, my parents owned two jewellery stores as I grew up. And they owned one in Gordon and one in Kalara in Woollahra in the eastern suburbs. And so our house looked like a mortuary half the time. It was like a museum. They were into antique jewellery. And I'll never forget the day my dad came home when he was 65 and retired from his job as the CFO. And he said to Mum, "I've retired today." And Mum said, "Well, so have I. Here's the keys to the shop. I'm not going back." Oh. And poor old dad then worked another 12 years running jewellery stores. I asked him, because they were collectors and they sort of got to an overflow position, and then he started selling through auctions. Then, of course, being my father, he became a licensed auctioneer, and then ultimately he opened two stores. And I said to him, why did you do this? And he said, look, apart from falling in love with jewellery, because it's very easy to do, and especially antique jewellery because it comes with a history, he said, it's the only stock that doesn't depreciate. Yeah. And I thought about that as I came into this business, that it is something that you do have to appreciate, that the stock you've got is valuable. And gee, if you look at the price of gold at the moment, it's very hard to argue with his logic. What he didn't point out is that it sucks up a lot of your cash though, and it can sit on your shelf for a long period of time.
He would have paid attention to.
Well, as a result, I mean, he turned 92 on the weekend. And if you go down to his unit at Narrabeen, retirement village, which is beautiful, he's just littered with antique jewellery all over the place. He's got this beautiful stuff. And I'm thinking, I'm going to have to sell this stuff one day. I wonder if I can sell this to Leading Edge. But I think what I'm trying to point out is that the jewellery industry does get into your blood. And despite the fact that that's not what attracted me to Leading Edge, I was invited here by the board because of my general background and my retail experience. The reality is that there's something about the uniqueness of jewellery. And I point to when you go online and you're searching for, you know, a diamond ring or a pendant or necklace or whatever, it is genuinely impossible, unless you're looking at it just a simple gold chain or a specific cut of diamond just by itself, your ability to compare product is nigh on impossible. And I think that the biggest advantage that a jeweler has in today's market is their ability to show their craftsmanship by creating that unique piece or that desirable piece, and know that look, it may be replicated by competition. But the truth is, if you go online to search for that particular ring or bracelet or whatever that they've just built, I don't even know where you begin to describe it, to compare it. Mm-hmm. And even then, if you go online, and I'm sure you've been online searching for different elements of jewellery before, I don't know what description you put in to come up with the outcome that you're looking for, because nine times out of ten.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah, you just don't get anywhere near it. So, again, if I point to your earrings right now, if you were to try and describe that for an eBay ad, I don't know where you'd start or where you'd finish, and I don't know if I'd be able to find it. Brett would, but I couldn't.
No, but you're right. It's a very visual, tangible, tactile thing that people have to touch and feel and see to fall in love with. It's very difficult. Beautiful photography helps a lot. And I think that, you know, if you're not in a space where you've got beautiful photography of your own pieces, then you need to move into that space 100%. But the benefit that jewelry has, and the reason why bricks and mortar will survive for the jewelry industry, on top of, as you said, a merged or hybrid approach with bricks and mortar and online, is that consumer desire and need to touch and feel the pieces.
Yeah, look, that's absolutely right. And I think what we all recognize is that the advantage bricks and mortar has over the internet is trust. So you know, when you go into that store, that there's a high probability it'll be there when you go back next time. Last week I was doing some research on internet sales, and it was revealed that currently 53% of all online sales that are meant to be returned by the consumer are not returned by the consumer because it's too much hassle. So all the costs are ridiculous. Yeah. So I think that most retailers these days, and most of our members, recognize that there's a high likelihood that your customer, when they're walking to your store, has done some significant research and education before they get there. But they're in your store for a reason. And they're in your store for a reason because, firstly, they want your expertise as one of our premium retailers and members. They want to understand why this is different to that, because it's not obvious when you're online. And then they want to know, when they do buy from you, what type of warranty they're going to get, what type of certification they're going to get to ensure that what they're buying is really the genuine product. And they want to know if something goes wrong, or later on, if they want to clean it, or they want to buy something that complements it, that these people are there to help. And you're not going to get that from some type of warehouse in Thailand. And you might get it cheaper, but you might get some surprises as well. And I think there's not one of us listening to this right now who hasn't bought something online and gone, oh, that wasn't what I thought I was getting. who ordered this? Oh, it was me. I'm an idiot. So I think I think that the learning for everyone at the moment is, the world's changed. We know that it's changed. We know that online presence is important. People do have to be able to find you. You do need to have to present yourself with some clarity, but you need to stand for something. And I think that many of our members are cornerstones of their local community. They love their products. They're artisans. They are very considered, and they don't sell for the sake of a sale because they live in that community. So it's very important that they maintain that honesty and that genuineness. And all they have to do is get their head around the fact that they can use the internet as their new billboard. And I think that, to be fair, a lot of them have struggled with that concept. A lot of them struggle with in-store advertising in a digital sense. They're used to catalogs as they were. And I'm sure that you read last week that Coles abandoned catalogs, Woolworths have already abandoned printed catalogs. There's reasons for this. It's even difficult to distribute them now because you can't find people who are allowed to in Victoria. So I think that we have to wake up to the fact that there's so much more research going on online. Businesses that are totally donated to online sales are reporting record profits. But we don't want to be there. We want to remain in touch with our local communities, and we want to rely on that tactile pleasure that you get from putting something on your own hand and saying, doesn't that look fantastic?
That's mine, yeah.
Especially if your sale is part of a strengthening of your relationship with your loved one. It's so important to be able to share that moment, and it's really hard to say no. You push the online sale button. No, you did it. I don't think you're going to get quite that sort of
feel. That you is it?
No. No, it's not. I don't know. Maybe there are more proposals done online than I think, but I'm just questioning that.
we talk a lot here about the small family type jewelers with Leading Edge. Is that basically the target audience for a Leading Edge member, or do you have larger multi-chain jewelers as well as members?
So, Brett, was multi-chain a clever play on words then?
Probably the wrong terminology for sure. Multi-store, maybe.
I think all of our members are multi-chain. we have some of our members own multiple stores, but that's more the rarity. I think we have to recognise that the amount of stock that your average jeweller will hold, even in a small business, between $500,000 and $1 million on average. So that's a lot of your home finances to be tied up in one spot. Multiply that by two or three, you've got to have a fairly successful business operation. And I'll be honest and say, in these times, that would be difficult to maintain. Even businesses in categories that are more essential than jewellery, I've found are struggling to keep open multiple stores. They would rather go online and close the store down purely because of the complications that come with running a store. Our members, therefore, are naturally smaller by nature. Obviously, we're not going to pick up Angus and Cooter or Michael Hill. They've got their own buying support and infrastructures. We're more likely to be attracted to those businesses that are doing it all by themselves, and they like the idea of community. They like the idea of being part of a larger network. We do provide benefits to our members that some businesses can't, and certainly can't by themselves. Certainly the ability to buy wholesale. We have our own wholesale business, jewelry business called MMC, and that provides unique buying power, which we can then share the benefits of with our members exclusively. So that's going to be obviously very attractive to our members, especially when they get to have an input into what that wholesaling business actually goes and purchases. So we work in collaboration with our members, especially around big events like upcoming Father's Day or Christmas, where they're clearly going to give us indications of the kind of stock that they believe will be what they want. And we'll go out and try and source that at the best possible price. The other advantage we've got is that our people involved in these businesses are also watching the most recent trends that are available from overseas, in particular Europe and the US, and we can bring that back and educate our members. And these are, you know, like coloured stones are the big things, or big hooped earrings are the big thing. Australia, it's fair to say, are a little slower on fashion uptake than the rest of the world, and we're not so influenced by that. You could pretty much talk to any jeweller anywhere in Australia and they'll be able to tell you what the top five sellers are. And it won't matter whether you're in Perth or Darwin or Brisbane or Sydney, you'll be talking about the same products by and large. Three out of five will be pretty much right on the money. Whereas in the US, it's a completely different world. And what I noticed, I was over in the US in January on the East Coast, and the way that they're trying to reinvent themselves through the jewellery industry is really quite fascinating, and taking very different approaches to products and services that they provide. And that was pre-COVID, I might add. I didn't realise when I was in Florida that would become a hotspot. Everyone was going to die. But what I did find out when I was talking to the jewellers there is that they're saying, look, we're moving into other areas in the way we merchandise and the way we sell, because we just can't do it the same way forever. We have to evolve. Things are changing around us. And of course, they were talking very much about online, but they were also talking about reinventing the way that they produce their services and how they source and where they get best bang for buck, and linking it to other products and services that you wouldn't traditionally do it with. And yeah, it was just very interesting to watch how they were thinking. And we've taken some of those ideas back. COVID slowed us up a little bit in trying to implement them, because we've got to be conscious that it might be fantastic to come up with some bright new ideas as to how we can do things. But if the member is struggling to have consumers walk past their store right now because it's in lockdown, it doesn't matter what we come up with. They're not going to be able to do much with that.
Don't miss out, guys, on the Jewellery Industry Virtual Fair, going live online on the 20th and 21st of October. Head to www.jewelleryindustryfair.com and we will see you there. Now back to the podcast.
Have there been other things that you found Europe leading the way in that we should potentially take advantage of and take the lead from?
It's a good question, because there's this fine balancing act between what might be attractive to the market and what is good for the industry. First and foremost, we really like to support our Australian suppliers, and we've got some real craftsmen here who do source fantastic product from overseas themselves and shape it into something that we can use. But I do think it's fair to say that you get flavour from different places, and Italy is a perfect example of a country that can create flavour overnight. And I think the only thing that's slowed everybody down is the price of gold. So as the economy is tanked, everyone's put their money into gold because it's safe. Now it's at record highs. Some of the beautiful pieces of jewellery that we have in MMC ready for sale are actually worth more melted down than when we bought them, because we bought them at a point that a year ago was worth X dollars. The price has doubled since then. The price of the ring that we've actually bought hasn't doubled. So I don't know how many consumers out there are thinking, I should just buy stuff and melt it down. I know that there's some pretty healthy margins in jewellery, but at the same time, it's a really interesting situation now. Supply is also our other major issue. So you can get all of these beautiful fashion tips from America and Europe, but getting the stock out of there has become problematic. And I'd rather go to our local suppliers and say, hey, we're finding that these big coloured stones are really popular overseas. It seems like they're starting to infiltrate the Australian market. Can you guys get your hands on more stuff like this? Can you provide us more interesting designs around this or that? I think that white gold looks, again, it rarely goes out of fashion. But it's also pretty popular. But yellow gold, of course, is just costing an arm and a leg. So you can't get enough chains for pendants and things like that at the moment. And again, it's quite interesting, because we're finding that it's easier to source that type of gold product from Europe than it is from Australia. It's actually cheaper. And that includes landing costs, which is ridiculous. So we've got to have a good look at ourselves as a industry and make sure that we remain relevant and competitive, because unfortunately, if this virus continues to knock us around like it is, and I have no doubt that a year from now we might be talking about the tail end of this, hopefully it'll have been finished, but when we're talking about it, we're going to say, unfortunately, we lost quite a few members to the virus. And I don't mean that they died. I mean that their stores didn't make it. And we're seeing more and more jewellery coming onto the market through auction houses and the like that is allowing us to think differently about where we might get some of our purchases as well.
And Australia has such a plethora of resources. We should be utilising what Australia, the country, has to offer. And if we are finding it's more difficult to bring things in from overseas, then we should be working really hard towards making sure that we don't need to rely on other countries as much as what we have in the past, considering what we have here.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And again, we're talking about jewellery, but I mean, when you start talking about precious stones and the like, we're now seeing the evolution of lab-grown diamonds and the like. And I know that a lot of traditional jewellers are sort of reeling back in horror, and some are spinning in their grave and they're not even dead yet. And the reality is, we know that mined diamonds are getting more and more costly to pull out of the ground, and they're becoming harder and harder to find. And I read somewhere fairly recently, it might have been even in one of your magazines, that 90% of all mined diamonds are already out of the ground. So you sort of got to think, what does our future look like? And here we've got a generation that's coming through in their 20s and 30s who are the new purchasers of diamonds. And they're saying, I want conflict-free. I want environmentally sourced. And when you compare a lab-grown diamond to a mined diamond, we know that from carbon compound and chemistry perspectives, they are identical. There are some very, very minor inferences that come through under different testing conditions that would point to the difference between one and another. But to be honest, at that point, you're comparing a Lamborghini and a Ferrari. You're sort of thinking, well, I'm not really picking up something that's cheap here. I'm still picking up a diamond. Mm-hmm. And the fact that lab-grown diamonds are going to be far more economic to purchase because it's easier to grow them than it is to mine them, then I think that we're going to have to face up to some realities in the future. And that is that while we know that a mined diamond has an enormous amount of value, that the consumers may dictate what is and isn't acceptable in the future. And I think that Tesla didn't have a car on the market 15 years ago. Now they're a highly prized item. Well, you ask yourself why, and there's a whole lot of good reasons why. I think we've got to face some facts that lab-grown diamonds, we're not talking about, a cubic zirconian here, they're a diamond. And there is a big difference between the two. And as long as everyone recognises that, it is what it is, I think you're going to find some jewelers very happy to be doing some designs there and making some very good margin purely because of volume as opposed to the uniqueness. So a $20,000 diamond ring might be replaced by a $5,000 diamond ring, except that you're going to sell 10 of the latter and only two of the former. And that's the new world I think that jewelers are going to be working in.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't feel like the designs are going to change too much, but it's certainly like you mentioned there that the retailer's foot traffic is going to lead the direction though with that one. I'm still on the fence personally, but I'm not ready to pull the trigger one way or the other just yet. But give it another 5 or 10 years, then it'll be a two-horse race.
I think the issue we've got, Brett, is that there's no legal requirement to call a diamond anything other than a diamond. If it was not a diamond, you couldn't call it a diamond. If it is, then you can. So a lab-grown diamond, there is no legal requirement at this point in time to say that it is lab-grown. I think that if you want to maintain a relationship that's honest with your consumer, you're going to have to think very hard about avoiding that. And I wouldn't personally. I think that it's important that you explain to the consumer what they are purchasing and why they're getting it at a better price than they would elsewhere if it was pulled out of the ground. But a diamond's a diamond. And I think that ultimately our consumers are going to tell us what they're prepared to do. And I think that it's an interesting position we're in as a society, because we've got to say to ourselves, well, if it is an issue about the ethical sourcing, about the costs, the environment, the conflict that goes with traditional diamond mining, and our new consumer doesn't like any of that, how fair is it for us to hang on to that? It's almost, dare I say, like hanging on to why ivory is so valuable. And I can't do that, and you can't do that, because ethically it just doesn't sit for us because of how those products are sourced, and that's just not acceptable in today's society, and that's fair. I think the diamonds are going to reach the same point sometime in the future, and we need to be ready for that. And we can pretend all we like that these simply are worth more because it costs a lot more to get out of the ground. There is no denying that, and anyone who says they're exactly the same are right in terms of the outcome, but not in terms of the effort that takes to get that outcome. And so that's what you're paying for when you're buying a diamond that's been pulled out of a mine in South Africa. The issue for you is that acceptable anymore? And I think that the industry over the next 10 years is going to face a lot of challenges regarding the argument that, this is a better product, because it's actually not a better product. It's just a differently sourced product that has attracted a lot of pain to get it into your hand. And that's what you're paying for. And I don't know if the consumers who are in their 20s are going to say, yeah, that's worthwhile. I'll pay that extra 300% because I don't think they're going to.
No, I tend to agree with you, Simon, for sure. I think there's definitely going to be people, consumers in general, the generation that we are raising at the moment, who will not accept anything that damages not only the environment, but people's livelihoods, or you know, if it's got an impact, a negative impact on the people that are mining it or the that are sourcing it or producing this product. So there'll be a definite need to shift our thinking, whether it's diamonds or whether it's mined gold as well, or whether it's even just the way that we produce our product, because the consumers will vote with their wallets. And if we're not on board with what they are wanting, then we can't convince them any other way.
Yeah, I think we can't pretend that things are steeped in tradition to such a point that they don't change. 100 years ago, there wasn't such a thing as a diamond engagement ring. I noticed you didn't wear a fur coat to this interview, Laura. And Brett's dropped. Yeah, that's right. And Brett dropped his ivory back scratcher sometime earlier in the conversation. There are reasons why we don't have certain things anymore in our lives, and it's not because they're not available. It's because we've made conscious decisions that this isn't right.
Yes, it's a very big, interesting topic, and one that we need to unpack a lot further in the industry and be prepared for. It's 100% we need to be prepared for, whether it's the conversation we need to be prepared for, or whether it's even just the way that we process things. We need to make sure that we've got the right tools in place so that in 5, 10, 20 years' time, we're still relevant to the consumer that's buying that piece for their special moment. So, yeah, you're bang on there, that's for sure.
I think most retailers, if they're smart, are just going to have a blend of two. They'll have traditionally mined and lab grown, and they'll show the same, and they'll talk to the consumer and say, this is the difference between the two. That's why this is cheaper than that. You're going to have your personal preferences. They'll cater for that. There is no doubt in my mind that very wealthy individuals who are later in life are going to not trust lab grown diamonds. And, I mean, we know it's only relatively recent that diamonds even got inscribed by lasers to actually prove that they weren't from, you know, they weren't blood diamonds and things like that. So we've had to do a whole lot of things to actually determine what is valid and what isn't, what's ethical and what's not. And that was before lab grown even was a terminology. So I think we're all getting a little bit more interested in what it is that we're ultimately prepared to buy and wear.
So with COVID, that's obviously been affecting us quite significantly in Victoria, and your ability to not be able to travel, because you started in February and you haven't been able to go anywhere. How have you been connecting with your members and all these new people that you didn't know before?
Look, we got a fairly quick wake up call like everyone else. Mine was a little quicker than everyone's, I think, because I started on the 1st of February, technically, and then in the third week of February, we had to move our offices to work from home. So we had 2 weeks, my first 2 weeks, to determine if we had the technology to be able to work remotely. We sorted that out. We did 1 week of trial, and then we went away and came back 2 months later. So we have been in a blended approach for several months now. And just so you understand, my team, I broke them into two. So we have a roster that has half the team work Monday, Tuesday, and the other half works Thursday, Friday. And that was on the basis that if anyone got sick, that I'd have half the business still able to function. So rather important. The jewellery business that we've got, because we've got the warehousing set up with MMC, they're in a very cloistered environment. And we put in all the COVID protocols that you'd expect, sanitizer everywhere, temperature checks every day, and they're in a very sealed environment, so they're easy to manage and monitor. All of the employees in the business now travel outside of normal office hours. They only, as I said, work in the office 2 days a week. And I've made a conscious decision with my leadership team that post-COVID, we will only work in the office 3 days a week maximum, because I like this work-life balance. We've had an increase in productivity, not a decrease. Right. I'm now lecturing my employees on working too long. Their days are blurring. And despite the fact that you'll see a variety of torn T-shirts and tracksuit pants over the course of video conferencing, they are kicking on too early, and they are, you know, kicking on again too late at night, and sometimes on weekends. So you've got to, as an employer, be very conscious of the advantages that you get over the disadvantages of having your workforce splattered everywhere. In fact, just before this call, I had an all-employee conference call, which we do every single week, where we just give everybody an update as to what's going on in the business. My leadership team meets twice a week online because we're not ever in the office at the same time together now. So what have we done with our members? Well, we've had to think differently, and we do a lot of video conferencing with them. We use Microsoft Teams to great effect. But also in my first month here, I recognized straight away that we were going to be in trouble with our communication because we simply couldn't travel to all the locations anymore. So we set up LEG TV. LEG TV with all the appropriate cameras, lighting, green screen room and the whole lot set up inside of 4 weeks by my guys. I was very proud of what they did. Right. And now we produce episodes every week, which goes to our members. And the reason we did that is because we recognised that they were time poor, they're under pressure, they were being stressed by a whole range of things. And I don't know about you, but we all got flooded with emails about how to manage COVID. And if I got one more email from anyone, I was going to die. So we changed the equation so that we could actually do 2-3 minute episodes and like mini podcasts, if you like, where we could update, educate. We talk to our suppliers to give us information, which we could relay to our members that way. And while we could always use the traditional email, and we've got an extranet that we use as a notice board, we needed to maintain that personal connection. And despite the fact that it was one-way traffic, because we're really just talking to people, we found that the reaction from our membership was very, very good. So all of my categories do multiple episodes every single week. I'm due to do one after I complete here. And in fact, what I'll be doing is doing an introduction to our town halls. So a town hall is where we get every single one of our members online at the same time, just like I do with our team meetings. And we give them a half hour online with a variety of speakers in 4 5-minute bursts. And then we do 10 minutes of questions and answers at the end. And we do that for every category in our business every quarter. And so the reason for that is, again, if we're a business that's built on community and we're a business that cares about helping small family businesses survive and thrive, we really do need them to be able to share their experiences, and we need to be able to talk to them in groups. And in fact, we've designed this so that twice a year, no matter what category of merchandise you're in, you're going to be in the same town hall. And that's so that you can understand that whether you're in jewelry or in books or in laptops or in electrical, you're all facing very similar problems. How do I make JobKeeper work for me? How do I get more foot traffic when they're closing me down? How do I get my online presence to work for me? How do I deal with staff who are going off the reservation in terms of their thinking? You don't have to be in jewelry to have the same problem. You just have to be managing people. And when I got into human resources, I was taught very early that if you have one person working for you, you've already got a problem. And that people are complicated and they're not all the same. So we do understand that people are people, and it doesn't matter where you're from or what you're selling, you're going to need people as part of that equation. So let's share the thinking, let's share the burdens. And by doing this, what we're finding is that in some of our towns, in regional centres in particular, members are starting to learn that, oh, that person over there, they're part of the leading edge group. I didn't realise that because actually they're in books or they're in computers, and I'm in jewellery. I'm only conscious of other jewellers in town. So I think that getting to understand that they're part of a supported nest of small family businesses that we're trying to look after is important to them, because it's good just to be able to go across the road and say, how you doing? There's not enough of that when you're working by yourself. And I think at the moment, isolation is our greatest enemy. And there's nothing that you can do more to hurt a retailer than telling them to close their door and go home and just sit and wait. And it doesn't matter how good your online presence is. That's not what they got into business to do.
That's right.
So it's very, very painful. And I think that we shouldn't understate the value of that human connect.
Yeah. No. And how many members would you have across the country?
We've got over 600 members in over 800 stores. So it's a fairly wide network, and they are genuinely everywhere, Brett. We do dominate more in country and regional states than we do in the big cities. It doesn't mean we haven't got operations in the cities, but I think, again, it's because of that community logic that we seem to attract more people who are out there in smaller environments. And I know that in my retail days that those small towns really rely very heavily on their local community to supply them, but at the same time are very quick to bypass them and go to larger regional centres because they've got more range, or to buy online, and then they complain bitterly when their local store closes down. So we're trying to help re-engineer the thinking of those local communities by saying to the consumer, look, come online, look at our stuff, and yes, you can get it in your local town from a person you know who will be there next week. Mm. And I think that that's really the big story that needs to be told, because if you don't do that well, they will find other ways to buy, and irrespective of the fact that it's usually a high price commodity, and that lends itself more to face-to-face purchases than online. If push comes to shove and you're desperate, you're going to buy online. I think our big saving grace at the moment is so many weddings and engagements are getting pushed back because of COVID. we're getting a bit more time to actually we'll get our act together a little bit using this time, I think.
Absolutely. I think it'd be interesting too to see eventually when we start to sort of see the consumer shift their mindset as well in regards to the way they see online, because even from a consumer's point of view, online means some big company that's far away that I have nothing to do with, that I can't access other than to contact them online. Whereas when you connect the dots between that online store, that online presence is actually linked to this local retailer, which is around the corner, is a very different mindset shift for the consumer, even, because they feel a very different space around then connecting with the online presence and with the retailer that's attached to that.
Yeah, look, I think you're quite right. And I can see in the not too distant future, once our members get their heads around how technology will work for them and that they're not actually cannibalizing their sales, they'll see that this type of conversation that you and I are having, they can have with their customer. They can show them the range. They can zoom in. They can show them pictures online. They can put ranges up with prices and all the rest while they're talking to a potential sale or customer, and they'll want all of that, and they'll say, okay, I'll come in next Tuesday and I just want to look at those two rings there, and that's what will happen. They may well just say, I want that one, send it to me now. I don't quite understand how our consumers will ultimately shape the way we sell to them, but they're going to change the way we sell to them. And anyone who just says, I'm going to do it the way that my dad showed me how to do it because that's who I got the shop from, are going to face an uphill battle. It doesn't mean they're going to go out of business, but gee, they're going to make life hard for themselves, because now the person who's shopping from them has already done their research. They've already seen everyone else in town. If anyone else in town has got a different approach and it's more convenient and it's more interesting, that's where your competition's going to be had.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. There's so much more involvement in the experience now, whether it's not just the purchase and the design, it's even just the unpackaging of the item. Like, you look on YouTube and how many videos there are on just unpackaging a new item.
That's right. And Brett, when you consider that a lot of our members sell intricate items like watches, that's a different world altogether. We've just talked mainly about jewelry today, but you and I know that watches are very unique timepieces and the ultimate men's jewelry, in my opinion. And I say that because I've got 27 watches. So if my wife is watching this podcast, I've got three. Okay. there is something to be said about beautiful timepieces, and you, like, I would not consider buying a Rolex online because it's too big a purchase for me. And I don't get to make that type of purchase very often, let me tell you. So I'd want to see it. I want to watch. I want to test it. I want to see it on my hand. I want to make sure that it's legit. I want to see the certification and all the rest. But I can compare lots and lots of Rolexes online and a lot of other beautiful brands. But I think that like most purchases, you want to be in that store. And I do think that it's the same with jewelry. It's just that watches lend themselves to a little bit different type of thinking because you know there's intricacies, but it is actually easier to compare different types of products because they actually are branded and it is a style and it is a year, kind of like Tiffany. So it's when you've got that type of brand presence around a particular item, it's a lot easier to go through the process in research. But the price points always force you into the store, unless you don't care about money. And I don't know too many people like that.
No, none of my friends anyway. If you had one message that you could leave with your members and with the industry at this time during COVID in particular, what would it be, Simon?
Look, I think the only true statement in life is this too will pass. I think that this is like a rain delay in a cricket match. If you're just going to sit there and play cards and wait for it to dry up, you're losing valuable time. This is the opportunity for you to reinvent yourself, to rethink how you can approach your customers and your market. It's your opportunity to re-educate yourself, but don't use this delay in trade or reduction in trade as an excuse for not getting better, because a lot of people I have talked to have shrugged and said, what else can I do? And I've closed my store and blah, blah, blah. I think that that's a recipe for defeat. And it's not fair to you and your family to give up that easily. This virus may be with us for a long, long time. And your chances of actually, you know, selling up and getting out of the business is pretty small right now. So have a good look at yourself and say, well, what do I do differently? Open up your mind. And the advantage you've got in being part of a business like ours is that we have got the expertise and we have got the education to help you think differently about the future that you have got in front of you. And I think that where there's life, there's hope. And I do believe that there is a massive place in Australian consumer future for bricks and mortar. It's not going to disappear. I think that we're going to get better outcomes in the end, not worse. You look at the Westfields of the world and they're going to have to think differently about the rent that was traditionally rather high. But I do think that our local communities are really currently very guarded, and that they consider their local suppliers preciously. And I think we've got to capitalise on that and say, let's help each other get through this. And a good retailer will be thinking about, well, how do I do that? How do I play my role? How do I convince my local community to come to me, not go to that other big regional centre or city? It starts with the reality that online is here to stay. You can do well with this, but you need research, you need history and education to go with that to make you a better retailer, and you will survive and you will get through this.
Wonderful. Wonderful and very wise words. Thank you, Simon.
Thanks for sharing so much with us today, Simon. I certainly did a lot of listening today, just taking it all in, but I really appreciate you going to so much depth on with everything you had to talk about.
Thanks, Brett. I'm glad you, glad you like listening, because I think that's what podcasts are about.
Yeah.
So I passed test one, but I've enjoyed our chat. It's been nice to meet you guys.
It's been an absolute pleasure having you on board. It's really appreciate your time, because we know how valuable it is and how many people you have to look after in the industry. There's hundreds and hundreds of them. So not just in our category, obviously, in the multiple other categories you look after. So really appreciate your time.
All right. Anytime. Thanks, Simon. Talk again.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us on the Jewelers Podcast.
Don't miss an episode by subscribing now on your favourite podcast player.
See you next time.